netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. Today we're going to speak with Stephen Poster, ASC, National President of the International Cinematographers Guild, Local 600 of IATSE. Stephen's been second unit director of photography on Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Blade Runner, so he has a definite visual effects tie-in, as well as DP on Big Top Pee Wee, Rocky V, Roswell, Donnie Darko, Stuart Little 2, The Box, and a long list you can see over at IMDb. I also want to mention Madonna's Like a Prayer video, quite an iconic video. I think you'll find it an interesting chat. We got to talk about how he got started in the business. I always like to ask people about that, about the digital transition cinematographers have been facing, how he feels we're doing in that transition, the relationship between visual effects and cinematographers, and also his strong feelings about a part of the color correction process on features that, frankly, he feels the industry is just doing wrong. I think that's a very interesting discussion. I also asked Stephen for his take on the efforts to organize visual effects into its own union. Before we get to that, I wanted to mention in the last podcast, as we wrap up this year, we mentioned a lot of the behind-the-scenes people who help us put together everything we do at FX Guide and FX PhD. I wanted to give a shout-out to some people you hear more front of the house instead of back of the house, the VFX show co-hosts, Red Center guests, FX podcast guests, you know, all the publicity people we work with throughout the year to get information about films and get hooked up with the right people to talk to. And then, you know, the people that spend the time, that actually take the time to give us interesting content that we can bring to you. I also want to single out the outstanding work that Mike Seymour and Jason Wingrove do on the Red Center podcast. I listen to everything we do here at FX Guide, and I have to admit, when I see that new Red Center is ready, I'm always the first one to volunteer to check it out and release it. I find it a fascinating discussion about, you know, it started out as Red Center to basically cover the Red camera. We obviously purchased Red camera number 22. We've done a lot of training on Red, but we've also been expanded. The Red Center has expanded to really cover all digital cinematography, from DSLRs all the way up to, you know, $100,000 cameras. So if you haven't been checking out the Red Center podcast, if you're listening to this podcast with Stephen Poster, I would assume you're interested in cinematography. I really recommend the Red Center podcast. It's done everything for me, from, you know, giving me basic information about workflow as it's been changing with some of these cameras over the years, to just hearing cinematographers talk about how they're approaching problems and gear reports that help you understand what's out there for tools that help you do the job. Anyway, it's fascinating stuff, and I personally just, you know, I really want to thank again everybody who's involved with us throughout the year, who helps us put this together and bring you the best content we can bring. Let's jump over now to the interview I did with Stephen Poster from the International Cinematographers Guild. So thanks for joining us on the podcast.
My pleasure.
Nice building, by the way.
Thank you. We're very proud of it.
Very nice. Yeah. We'll talk a little bit more about that later on. I wanted to start off, I think it's always interesting for people to find out how people got into the business.
You know, I started getting interested in photography when I was 10 years old, and kind of quite arbitrarily, nobody in my family other than amateur home movies and box brownies were into photography on that level. And I got interested in it when I was 10. And then by the time I was 12, I knew that my life was going to be photography, was going to be in photography in some way. I had no idea what that meant at that point. You know, I just knew that I loved it, and I knew that there were ways of making a living at it, and whether that was shooting bar mitzvahs and weddings, I had no idea, or news. I had no idea, but I knew that I would pursue it. And when I was 14, I was sitting in my living room one kind of fall afternoon, and in Chicago, in the suburbs of Chicago, and I saw a car drive up to an empty lot next door to us, and it was an old Jaguar, and I saw this guy get out. He was wearing a cap, he had a beard, he was smoking a pipe, and he had a light meter on his belt. And I ran out of the house as fast as I could, and I said, "Hi, my name is Steve, I live next door, what kind of light meter is that?" And he said, "Son, we'll have a lot of time to talk about that, I'm building a house next door." he became my mentor. His name was Maury Bleckman. I've talked about him many times. He was a CBS newsreel cameraman and owned the film lab, the 16mm film lab in Chicago for news. And he was a tough old son of a bitch. He was a great guy, but tough teacher. The day I met him, I thought he was the coolest thing I'd ever seen, and I wanted to be him. Consequently, I smoked a pipe for many, many years. I had a beard. I still have a beard, and I tried to drive Jaguars, but I ended up in other kinds of cars. But I definitely tried to be him, and he was a wonderful teacher. But he kept me out of news. He said, "No, you have a different path," and he was right. He insisted that I study still photography because at the time there weren't that many schools around teaching cinematography, and he knew that I wasn't that great of a student, so I wasn't going to get into USC or NYU. But I did go to Southern Illinois University to study still photography. Now, because I was such a bad student in high school, I was placed in a special class for classic underachievers, because I had high scores on my tests, on my college tests, but I did very poorly in school. And they were doing this experimental program at Southern Illinois University that was through the section that I was in. It was an all-school experiment, but the section I was in was the most experimental section, and it was run by Harold and Mary Cohn from the design department, along with Buckminster Fuller.
Oh, my.
So I had I was turned on to education and the concept of design as problem solving and learning in a way that I had never been taught before. I was taught to learn. Nobody ever taught me that before. But along with that, I was given a great appreciation of the concept of design and problem solving in the idea of whether it's graphics or three-dimensional or whatever you're doing, you are solving problems. And that's what we do, you know, for a living. We solve problems. So from there, I went to Art Center. I was at Art Center. I left Southern Illinois after my second year. That program was a one-year program, and then I was in the photography department after that. I entered a contest there and took a bunch of gold medals and said, you know, there's not enough competition at this school, and I wanted to go somewhere else. At the same time, I was very involved. It was 1964. I was very involved with the civil rights movement, student Peace Union, another of several other organizations. I was also involved with broadcast and television and theater. But because I was involved with civil rights, and that was the hotbed right there in Southern Illinois, there was a, you know, quite a little Klan population that I found out later. And I woke up and I had a gasoline cross burned in my lawn one day, and I said, I'm getting out of here. And Wow. Very quickly made an application to Art Center, got in.
Here in Los Angeles.
Here in Los Angeles. At the time, it was the Los Angeles Art Center College of Design over on 3rd and near Highland. And they've since moved out to Pasadena. And it's quite an amazing school. Again, a design discipline to teach you how to be a professional. And I was there for 2 years and learned... I'll tell you, probably the most important thing I learned there was how to see light. Not how to light, but how to see it. And it became intuitive. And the stuff that I learned from a guy named Charlie Potts there was, it stays with me. It's stuff I think about every single day of my life. But I also, it's a very tough school, and I ended up learning how to be a professional. From there, there was a girl back in Chicago, and I wanted to get back there, and we were talking about getting engaged. And so I got my final degree, my degree, from Illinois Institute of Technology. Also, the Institute of Design, also a design discipline. So I had the Bauhaus, I had Bucky Fuller, I had Art Center, I had a real terrific, for a terrible high school student, I had a wonderful, wonderful college education in the concepts of design and art and lighting and how to see light and how to compose and how to sell myself. And by the senior year in Chicago, I was already doing commercials, documentaries, industrials, educational films, anything that I could to put film through a camera. And that started my career.
Hmm. I see a lot of photographs in your office.
As a matter of fact, I am still an art photographer, very, very involved. These are part of a show that's been traveling around to museums around the country. I just closed a big gallery in Atlanta. I'm going to have a show in Pomona in January.
Oh, awesome.
A nice big show in Pomona. They span, this show spans about a 40-year retrospective. So, I'm still very involved
in
photography.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
Absolutely.
I guess so, yeah.
And if anybody's interested, stephenposter.com.
Oh, great.
You can take a look at them.
Oh, great. So then, how did you move into, you said you started shooting commercials and industrials and building up hours, basically, and getting that experience. How did you then transition into films themselves and TV shows? I mean, your resume, you've done films, TVs, shows, you've done just about music videos. I mean, you know, how did you make that transition?
You know, I kind of got to the point in Chicago where I sort of used up the market. I knew I was ready to move to Los Angeles. In reality, I think had I stayed in Los Angeles those 10 years that I was back in Chicago, I might have been much farther along in my career when I finally came out here. But you know, love conquers all, right?
Mm-hmm.
I never ended up marrying her, by the way. I married another woman and then another woman, and now I'm on my third wife, but three is the charm. I think that there was moments when I thought I would never be able to shoot like the guys in Hollywood. It bothered me. I would look at the film that I shot, and it just didn't have the depth or quality of the kind of stuff I saw on the big screen. And then I did a short. I had a partner who was a writer and a director, and we were sitting around the kitchen one summer and said, you know, I got some short ends. I can borrow a camera. Let's go out and make something. Let's write a script, Mick. And Mick, my partner, Mick Dirks, came back with a script that we liked, and we made this short. It turned out to be a huge production, 35mm, full on. We had horses riding down Rush Street. It turned into quite a big deal, and it ended up winning the prize at the Atlanta Film Festival, winning the best short in the festival at that time. Well, they were screening at the Fox Theater in Atlanta, which was a giant screen, and it was the first time I ever saw my stuff that big. And I looked at it, and it looked like the stuff they were doing in Hollywood. It was a huge revelation. It was very exciting to see it. I mean, you know, tears were rolling down my eyes because I realized that the difference between the small screen, screening it on a small screen, even projected, of course, video wasn't really in those days used very much, and it was projected on a big screen, and it just opened up in a way that I had never seen my stuff before. So I mean, I was thrilled and said, okay, I'm ready. Hmm. And from there, I got involved with several second units. One of them was Close Encounters, which was my first big visual effects movie. I hung around as much as I could with Doug Trumbull and Richard Jurasich and those guys, and did a lot of little shots for them. But then Stephen finally would trust me enough to go out and do some full scenes and pieces that they needed. So that was a summer of complete joy and education. I just immersed myself. I even got to run an arc. The gaffer said to me, "Kid, if you're going to grow up to be a DP, get up there and run that arc." And I was up in the perms, way up 90 feet up in the air, running, learning how to run an arc from the guys, how to maintain it, how to put the coals in, how to strike it, how to keep it going. you know, wow. invaluable. Yeah. And so I really got another education on that movie. But I was introduced to visual effects in a way that I'd never, ever seen before. I knew from dissolves and fades and things that you could do on an optical printer, but I had no idea this stuff was the very biggest at the time, the biggest set ever built for a motion picture, and it was extended, not digitally, but extended photographically with visual effects. It was to be in the presence of Doug Trumbull and learn from him and learn from Richard Jurasich and learn from those guys was a gift. It was just an absolute gift, and I did as much as I could with it. You know, I've had such a great, rich history of working with people like Doug Trumbull and Richard Edlund, and Jerome Chen, Blair Stribley, Richard Hoover, Thomas Tannenberger. Thomas and I have done three movies together now for Richard Kelly. We've had such an amazing experience together, all of these guys and myself, in terms of creating a world that you wouldn't have seen otherwise. That I value those relationships tremendously. I think that we are partnered as a visual effects and cinematographer team. I don't see it as I've never, ever once had an adversarial position, a relationship with a visual effects supervisor and the artists that I work with. I think that it's so important to have them with you at all times and to be with them at all times and to talk about this stuff and design stuff and understand what the capabilities are and what the tool sets are.
I noticed when I was looking through your resumes, beside that Close Encounters was on there, obviously, in Blade Runner.
Oh, yeah.
And Big Top Pee-wee?
Big Top Pee-wee. I love that movie.
Classic.
But, you know, and a number of visual effects movies, certainly.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons. Other reasons I wanted to talk to you is just so much. You do cross paths with visual effects. And as I was saying when I came in, you know, when I walk onto set as a visual effects supervisor, one of the first people I meet, well, the first person I tried to get to is the DOP to make sure that relationship is as solid as possible, because that's so important. I find that that's the person on the set and the first AD are the people that I need them more than I need the director in a lot of cases.
Well, absolutely, and it's so important to have that relationship. As some of the visual effects supervisors that I've worked with over the years will tell you, we are partnered. Absolutely, from the beginning, we are partnered. I just got through working on Cats and Dogs with guys from Tippett and guys from Sony ImageWorks, and we really spent a lot of our time together. It's not the kind of thing that you can just dismiss and say, oh, it's just visual effects, let them do what they do. And I'm involved. I believe that every element of every frame informs the audience. So I want to be involved on that level where I have a certain amount of control, but also an input when I can over things that I can't have control over, to make sure that they flow through from my original concept of the image to the screen. And I stay with the movie until it goes on the screen. It's just something I've always done and always will do. Now it's becoming even easier because you can do it remotely. There are ways now to do this remotely. But one thing I learned when I was doing Stuart Little 2, most important flow through, the most important part of the workflow is, to me, when before something goes to a compositor, it is lab graded, RGB, gamma gift lift gain, so that the compositor has an idea of what world,
right,
it lives in.
Yes, I've worked on one movie of all the things that I've worked on that was done that way, and it was night and day better.
Oh my God, Oh my God, it was just amazing. And I've had, you know, I've had visual effects producers say, no, you can't do that. Why not? Because I don't want it on my budget. But it's going to cost a lot more later. That's all right, I'll be gone. I've had them tell me that.
So I want to talk to you about digital. Obviously, there's been a lot of transition in the last couple of years to digital. I know you were an early adopter. Years ago, you were doing tests with NHK, wasn't it?
NHK, Sony, and Panavision. We did tests in 1990, I believe it was, and we were trying to show how this new format of recording on tape could be used to make motion pictures. Of course, in those days, it was called High Vision in Japan. It had a number of different names until it settled down to high definition, but it was quite exciting. I remember we did a shoot that we went up to Northern California and created a short for it. And about two-thirds of the way through, they brought this digital recorder to us and said, let's try using this digital recorder instead of the bread truck full of equipment and engineering facility that had been following us around, and we were tethered to that. Now that little one-inch digital recorder could be put in the insert car where we were. We didn't have to have a truck following us, and we could record on it. And that in itself was a huge breakthrough.
Sure.
You know, going from an entire truck with two-inch quad to something that was one-inch and portable. So you can imagine where we've gone to in 20 years.
Sure. I mean, we've shot a lot of interviews for FX Guide TV. We have a video podcast as well. And, you know, I grew up in the television days of going out with a one-inch portable deck or, you know, even 60-millimeter mm-hmm. film and things like that. And, you know, just such an amazing amount of light you needed, production, you know, big crew. You needed a Bronco to handle everything. And now, you know, I can fit it all in a backpack.
I know. And you needed an engineer to sit there and say, don't shoot that. It's too bright.
Right.
But in fact, I heard these words uttered for the first time in 1972, and I will never forget it. Film is dead. In 1972, they said, film is dead. So what is that? Almost 40 years now. Now, we have reached a point, a very interesting kind of point in the evolution of all of this technology. I think we've reached a tipping point where we now see just so many different systems and ways of recording images and putting those images out on a big screen or even a small screen. We're in an explosion of those kinds of imaging acquisition systems right now.
It's got to be exciting from a cinematographer standpoint to have a lot of choices, I would think.
It's exciting to have choices, but the problem is we're seeing those choices being sold to producers and directors and actors as opposed to being sold to directors of photography. The choices are coming at us based on economics, not based on the proper choice for the film. And that's a big danger. You know, when a producer is given the use of a red camera, for instance, and he says to the cameraman or camera woman, this is what you're going to shoot with, it doesn't allow us to choose. You know, we've never been told by anybody before that you have to use this emulsion. Maybe this film company or that film company, but you know, we were not told quite how to do it in that same way.
Sure.
Now they're you know, it's coming at us from all different ways. You know, there's these wonderful little animated things on the internet about the producer and the cinematographer talking about which camera and all of the director and these funny little
extra normal or
extra
like
normal
that. Yeah,
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 they're wonderful. They're
yeah.
wonderful commentaries, but they reflect reality. That's
sure.
the scary part about
right.
it.
I heard that Favreau and Spielberg had to fight to shoot film for Cowboys and Indians, and they were like, it's a Western.
Yeah.
You know, we want that gritty, you know, we want that feel, the feel of film. But, we want
and,
that.
And that's great, and there are wonderful traditional ways of doing things. In fact, you know, look at two of the movies that we're dealing with right now in Oscar season. We're dealing with Black Swan, which was shot on Super 16, and Inception, which was shot on 35 millimeter and 65 millimeter. And these are two of the best looking films of the year. So does that make film better than digital? Does that make digital the usurper? Does it, you know, these are all questions that should be answered based on the project.
Right.
On Black Swan, Matty Lebatique, who shot that, did Super 16 because Aronofsky and he had done two of their other movies in Super 16, and they were very, very successful, which shows the quality of film emulsions now, that you can show shoot a movie on Super 16 and have it be less expensive than shooting on digital, and actually in some cases prettier. And on top of it, there were 300 visual effects in that movie. So you're not talking about a medium that you can't do visual effects on.
Mm-hmm.
It's just how it's post-processed, you know?
Right.
So, but now we have a number of cameras. This is going to be a very exciting year. We've already seen the introduction and now implementation of the Alexa. Everybody's excited about that. Why are they so excited? Because it's a simple system. The workflow is simple and direct, and the color science is impeccable. Okay, we have the, you know, you take that on one end. You take the high end stuff, which is the Genesis, still a brilliant camera. The F-35, which is the mirror of the Genesis, and people have opinions one way or the other, but I think they're very similar cameras. You have the F-23. You have the red cameras. I know my opinion is well known on the red cameras. In fact, Variety last week had a piece where I talked about the quality of skin, and in fact was also quoted in there was Nicole Kidman talking about that because she wasn't happy with that. However, we're going to see the new Epic this year.
Right, yeah. Just started shipping that, I guess, to first customers this week. So.
They're shipping to first customers, and they're doing their promotional deal, and mm-hmm. you know, whatever they do, they don't sell to directors of photography. They sell to producers and directors. But we're also seeing the implementation of the use of DSLRs.
You just shot a film with that, didn't you?
I shot partially. Okay. I had the new chip, Reds, and I had two 7D Canons completely outfitted so that they were production tools. Mm-hmm. You can walk into Best Buy and walk out with a camera, but can you shoot a movie with it? Not very likely, but people are shooting all kinds of things with them.
Sure.
And the low res quality of the files that you get out of them is not borne out by what you see on the screen. I actually am now getting ready to do the DI on this film Flypaper with the Reds and with the 7Ds. And in some ways, I'm actually liking the look of the 7Ds better than the Reds. But that's a personal, you know, it's a personal mm-hmm. opinion.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who love the Reds.
Sure.
And the Epic will make a difference. We now have the Sony F3. The Sony F3 is a $16,000 list, probably go out for about $13,000 camera. That's a full-size chip. But it's a camera for documentaries, industrials, small features, independent features, television shows. It's a remarkable piece of equipment that Sony has come out with. Sony's also got to show us a prototype of a DSLR size camera that will be less expensive Still a full chip, full-size chip, but it will be more capable of doing what the DSLRs are doing right now in that same format. We're going to see an explosion. Nikon's come out with theirs. I'm sure Canon must be working on something.
Yeah, the rumors about mirrorless DSLRs.
You know, I those pellicle mirrorless cameras, they're not mirrorless, they're pellicle cameras. Mm. And in those pellicle, I used the first ones with Canon Pellex cameras in the late 60s. I had those cameras, and they were wonderful because they didn't have a mirror going clunk, clunk. That's a great way to work with that format camera. So we're going to see probably toward the end of next year. I hope we'll see another camera from Panavision that will be pretty remarkable. I think Sony's going to come out with another 4K camera that's a small camera. So we're seeing an explosion in the market of imaging technologies. Where it's going to come down to is, number one, color science, and number two is workflow.
Well, and it seems like the holy grail had always been to get as good as film, or at least acceptable. It seems like we're at that verge right now where we're starting to see cameras with expanded range and
the
possibly...
The Alexa has, like, it's shooting on two chips at the same time. I forget quite how they do it, but their dynamic range is incredible. I hear the Epic is, but
yeah,
probably
HDRX,
not as good,
whatever, yeah.
But it's probably up there as well.
So we're starting to exceed film in some ways. It seems like the technology is going to be there eventually.
Maybe in range of in dynamic range, you're exceeding film, and in a lot of ways, that's kind of exciting, giving us the capabilities. I think what we're also seeing on the back end of this stuff is the fact that there are more and more digital theaters out there with good projection. I'm not necessarily talking about 3D, because I don't think we're quite there with good projection yet, but there are a lot of good digital projectors and digital theaters. Does that mean that we still have to emulate film if in the post process, because we have these chips that have so much more dynamic range, and we can express that on the screen digitally in a way that we weren't able to before when we were going back to film? You were limited by the dynamic range of the print stock and the projection system. Now, we could actually throw out that emulation. I mean, this is heresy amongst, you know, our traditionalists. But we can throw that out and come up with something else, still within an expanded color space.
Mm-hmm.
Because you do need to, we could talk about the numbers, Rec. 709 versus this versus that versus whatever. You still need the expanded color depth that you get with these kinds of film emulations. However, and in fact, we'll see the ACES system come out from the Academy soon, and that's an even more expanded range system. So there's all of this stuff coming at us from left and from right and from top and from bottom that makes it for a very, very exciting time. You know, when you can consider going out and making a movie, I would consider on a very low budget movie, which somebody's actually talking to me about one right now, but it's something that I would actually consider doing because I love the script. I'd consider using the Sony F3 for it. I think that might be a brilliant camera for those kinds of movies. On the other hand, I know that I can go out with a Panavision Genesis and make a brilliant movie that nobody could tell wasn't film, wasn't digital. You know, it's got its own quality, and I think that's where we have to go. We have to adopt each one of these systems for their own qualities.
You guys have been very involved with training for members about a lot of the stuff. I know you did a lot of stuff when the position of DIT kind of came to be. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Our Okay, I think that the thing that I came in as president to do was to service our members in a way that I didn't think that they were being serviced before. Yes, we had a training program, but it was not directed toward what is happening in our world today, tomorrow, and in the future, and how are we going to keep our members the best in the world, so that when a producer says, "I need this position filled," we can say, "We've got it." So what we've done is we've created a training program that is essentially dealing with whatever comes in the future, whatever comes up, we create a training program for it. For instance, when digital downloading when file-based downloading became the method of choice for a certain level of production, we developed a program that standardized all of the methodology for digital downloading, no matter what kind of file-based system you were doing. And we took that around the country. In fact, we're still doing that. We have one coming up in Dallas in January, where we go to not necessarily the production centers, although we've done them in Chicago and New York. I'm in Chicago. We've done it in L.A. and New York, but we have done it in Chicago. But we go to somewhere where it's an airport hub, and if our members get themselves there, we put them up for the weekend and feed them a few meals and train them in these standardized methods of dealing with stuff, train them in how to protect the image, train them in how to deal with new technology, train them as digital imaging technicians. One of the first things I did when I came in, you know, everybody used to say, who's your dit? Get me the dit. I want to talk to him or her. I changed that culture. I hated that. I hated that in it with a passion. These are not dits. They are digital imaging technicians, or DIT for short. Let's give them the respect of the job, and let's make people understand that this is a necessary position within the hierarchy of a camera crew. So you know, that came from years ago. I was a member of the Canadian Union after shooting a movie called Strange Brew many years ago. Many of you will remember that wonderful beer movie. But I noticed on their rate cards they had a position of Director of Photography Electronic, DOPE. And seriously, so I didn't want DIT to be the acronym for digital imaging technology technicians. So I changed.
Oh, that's good. It's that. Kind of an important role on the set these days.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, I think it's not only to our training program is not only to keep our members up to date, but it's also to show the industry that we are ready for whatever comes along. Our 3D training is remarkable. We created. I had lunch one day with Gary Martin, who's head of production over at Sony, and Gary and I had created the high definition training when the 900s first came out for directors of photography. And I said, I'm having trouble trying to train my people in 3D. He said, well, we've been thinking about this too, and we want 3D to be good for everybody, no matter who does it and where it's done. So we'd like to create a training program. So we got together, and our training committee and myself and Buzz Hayes and the guys over at Sony ImageWorks, now Sony 3D Technology Center, put together a fabulous training program. We've trained over, I think now up to almost 500 people of our members in how to understand that 3D is a different language, and it is a different language. It is a completely different language, and you really need to know what you're doing in order to work in that language. And that's continuing. Sony has found it to be so successful that they're continuing. They're expanding it to directors and expanding it to other areas, but it's still going to be a training program, a very, very advanced training program for our members as well.
You know, I want to go back to the idea of color correcting, you know, before it gets to visual effects. And you were saying that you know, a lot of times that's a fight with the budget and that kind of stuff. I mean, what can we do about that? Do you have any ideas?
You know, the reality of that is that it doesn't cost anymore. It really doesn't. And in fact, it saves money down the line, because whatever I'm doing by timing those things flows through to the post, to the final DI. It's not like it's going to go away and then you have to start over again.
Right.
In fact, that's why I try to get the companies to give me 3 days of DI before it goes out to preview. You know, because whatever I do there is going to flow through to the end, and whatever I do there is going to help sell the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're much closer to the end product. You know, I can go through, I can color time with a good colorist.
Well, that's I was going to talk to you about that, what the relationship between yourselves and colorists, because that's got to be a...
Oh, I've had a wonderful experience with that. I've been very, very lucky with that. But, I can go through an entire movie and do the color, just grade it in a way that just gives you an even tone throughout and has the original concept in it in 3 days. I can do it in 3 days. I've done it in 3 days. And that 3 days will flow through to the end, and you can take those 3 days off of the end. So where's the cost? You know, there is no cost in it. It's just a matter of time and people understanding that this will help their movie. We still don't have an end-to-end device-independent color management system. We're still a long way off of that, no matter what anybody says about, oh, well, we'll bring it onto the set. And you know, first of all, bringing color correction and bringing that kind of work onto the set, who's got time during production to do that? I mean, yeah, I go back to my room or in between takes when I'm sitting around waiting for something, I'll run to my computer and I'll have taken still photographs and I'll correct them and I'll send them to the lab or I'll send them on as a reference. But who has time to do that kind of grading on the set? I don't.
Yeah, you don't need the distraction.
You don't need the distraction. I think that's like a big kind of hype that people saw some kind of business model that they could make some money on. And in fact, in certain cases, it probably is valid. On a big visual effects movie where you need it to flow through,
right?
Maybe that is valid.
But yeah, they may have been talking about stereo too, so maybe it's an idea of being able to get a sense of stereo stuff. I don't know. I found it a little odd, too. I was wondering about that.
Yeah, well, that's another subject, stereo, isn't it? But I think that's what we're missing. We're missing that holy grail, that color management system that's end-to-end and device-independent.
Yeah. Well, what are the one speaker called them? Snowflakes. The workflows are snowflakes.
That's
every
Leon,
one of them is different.
Leon Silverman. Yeah. I quoted him in my editorial this month.
I mean, every show I've been on has different stuff, different workflow, and everybody talks about that.
I
and
made
that
it
costs
a practice.
Money.
I made it a practice. Even on film shows we're shooting film, I get everybody to sit down together in a meeting before the show starts and have a discussion about workflow. Let's design the workflow. Post-production, the editorial post-production, on the set people, the digital downloader, everybody is involved in this. Every department that has anything to do with this is involved with this discussion. So we know precisely what that snowflake is going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
Because Leon's right. They all are different. Every one of them is different.
Yeah, but I think that will save money and everybody headaches if we eventually get to a workflow that can be decided on and make sense.
Well, they have to have, that camera has to output something that makes sense. Most of the workflows we're seeing on the new cameras that are coming out are pretty simple and direct.
Driving over here, the drive past the Directors Guild, and of course pull up out front and your building, the cinematographer's building, and then right next door is the Editors Guild building, and I just you know, we're going through a period right now in visual effects where there's organizing efforts by IBW and IATSE.
IATSE.
Thank you. To
International Alliance of Theatrical and Stage Employees.
You told me I shouldn't say IATSE, so I've been I've been trying to break myself.
Right. Call it IATSE or the International Alliance.
So, what would you say to visual effects people who are hearing all this and starting to, you know, hear this drum beat and, you know, what has it meant to you, for example, to be a member?
There's a level of family that everybody hopefully has experienced one time in their life, that this level of family protects you, clothes you, makes sure you're healthy, makes sure you're not taken advantage of, makes sure that you're compensated for what you do right. And this attitude of family is something that you can't get in this business any other way than through a union or through a guild. I've always been amazed at the independence and the lack of organization that has existed in the visual effects community. I have many, many friends who are in that community, who work in that community, who work around the clock to do the best work they possibly can. And how are they protected? How are their families given health benefits and retirement benefits? And what's going to happen when they work in the industry for 30 years and turn around, or 40 years and turn around and say, I've got nothing except my paycheck? I think this is a time that's absolutely ripe to organize the workers in the field of the visual effects world. I think it's necessary. I think that you guys and women have to stand up for yourselves and say, not only do we want the respect that we deserve, but we want to be compensated in a way that gives us a quality of life that we don't have right now. And the only way you're going to get it is by working together to get it. And the only way of working together is by working through a union. So I can only urge you that the quality of life that I enjoy as a union member, and I'm 40 years in, and my pension is secured, my health benefits are secured, this is something that you cannot get in any other way. Nobody's going to turn to you and say, I'm so benevolent, I'm an employer who's so benevolent, I'm just going to give you all this stuff. You have to fight for it. You have to fight for working conditions that are humane, that are healthy, that are protected in a way that you cannot get it in any other situation. That's why the organizing effort of the IATSE to organize visual effects people is so important. Forget about IBEW. IBEW is not going to give you what we can give you. We are the motion picture and television union. And I think that's where you guys belong.
So I hear visual effects artists that are looking for answers for a lot of these things. And a lot of the people that are negative about the union idea, the things they always say are, oh, all the jobs are going to leave. Everything's going to be outsourced. Everything's going to go away. And, you know, I can get healthcare on my own. And, you know, I'm just trying to suck up information. I'm just trying to learn. And when I've heard you speak on this topic, I'm always like, hey, I want all that. You know, when I heard you with that Hollywood, the HPA thing, I was like, wait a minute. That's all the things that everybody in visual effects should have.
That's all the things that every worker in the world should have. You know, and what makes you think, even if you don't unionize, that the jobs are going to stay here? We got to fight to keep the jobs here, regardless of whether you're unionized or not. If you're unionized, there's a platform to work from. There's a way that we can work together. But if you're fractioned into hundreds and thousands of different little people working in garages, or groups working in a company here, another group working in a company there, how are you going to ever achieve anything as a group to try and move the industry forward? Can you envision a time when jobs aren't going to leave here? Only if the dollar turns around. You know, can you envision a time when there won't be any work in Canada, or there won't be any work in Europe, or Eastern Europe, or China, or you know, around? No, that's going to happen, and the competition is stiff. Having a union isn't going to affect that one way or the other. The only thing it's going to do is make the workers and have an agreement with the producers so that it's not the Wild West out there. You know, when I was young, all I wanted to do was put film through a camera. I didn't care about anything else. I just wanted to put film through a camera. Did I think about what was going to happen 40 years from then? No, I didn't think about the concept of a pension. I didn't think of, I was healthy at that time. I didn't think about health care. What did I need health care for? You don't. And when you're that age, you know, it doesn't strike you that you have a future, and in that future you're going to need things that you don't even think about now. You know, and I just learned over the years how important it is to be personally involved in the destiny, your own destiny of how you're going to exist years from now. And you just don't think of it when you're young, and and maybe you shouldn't, but if you have an organization around you that protects you and that gives you the kind of future that you don't even think about at that point, then you're going to be okay. But you really need to have some kind of organization looking out for you. You know, to be able to say, I'm going to have the quality of life that I deserve because I'm a worker and I work hard and I put a lot of effort into this and I want to have something back out of it. You know, there right now, I know, I have friends in the business, and I know that there are sweatshop conditions in visual effects. It's true. I know that they'll set up dorms out of town in a small town somewhere and bring in the computers and put people to work on a night and day basis to try and finish something. And
they'll do that in downtown Hollywood and Santa Monica. And,
I know.
It's not. I've had friends who have, you know, passed out from working too many hours.
And, yeah. Yeah.
You know, their stories are rampant in visual effects worldwide. I mean, I've heard stories of people bringing sleeping bags with them to work on Monday, knowing that they're going to be there through Friday in different places. So.
I know. And you know, why? For the thrill of working on X, Y, and Z movie? No, it's because you love what you do, you want to do it, and you go in there without any kind of... We're artists. We don't need to understand that there should be limits on stuff. But that's what the organization is for. That's what we do to take care of people. We protect you from those kinds of abuses. We protect you so that you're safe. We protect you so that you have your health. And we protect you so that you have a pension later in life.
Well, I'd like to thank Stephen for spending some time to talk to us. I think those union thoughts at the end of the podcast were very powerful. And, you know, I hope that... the discussion on this stays, it's tended to wander a bit in some of the forums out there. And I think part of that is, as I've mentioned before in these podcasts, the fact that the organizers for this have just chosen not to really have a web presence and give people actual hard details that they can talk about and share and with their friends and raise the level of the discussion. So the discussion kind of slides down. And I think it's good to hear from people who are actually involved with unions, and it's most of the people on the film crew about their thoughts, and I think that Stephen spoke very eloquently about that, and he's a very passionate person about that subject, so I thank him for that. I also was really fascinated by his background, the whole Buckminster Fuller background training and learning to see light and photography, life lessons, you know, life lessons of things, you know, how he felt about if he had stayed in Los Angeles longer. I think that kind of stuff is just really interesting for people starting out in the industry to hear about how people made their journey. And also I had to chuckle at the anything to shoot, the whole concept of short ends, growing up in the era that I did, you know, going over to a friend's house and finding their refrigerator or freezer full of rolls of film, short ends from the ends of shoots that they're saving to either save money on a shoot or do a side project. I mean, now obviously, you know, we just buy another card from B&H and keep in our pocket for shooting something, but you know, it's an exciting time now, But, you know, kind of missed some of those terms, short ends. Not really going to be a term anymore in the coming years. Also, I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast intro, the Red Center podcast, and there was an interesting discussion over there recently when we talked about the new Epic camera, talking about how the price point and the size, that that technology is going to change into multiple cameras on the set. I mean, it really is already starting to happen. You start hearing numbers about 15 cameras or 20 cameras being used to shoot new features with the Epic and stereo and multiple cameras for the stereo. And I think it's an interesting technology coming that's going to, you know, besides the low light stuff, the cost and the flexibility of these cameras is really going to change on-set stuff in a drastic way. I'd love to actually get Jason and Mike to sit in a room with Steven and have a more Red Center-focused podcast on some of these exact topics, but we'll see. Maybe we can make that happen in the coming year. Well, that'll do it for the FX Podcast for 2010. For my partners, John Montgomery and Mike Seymour, I'm Jeff Huser. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.